Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
It's all about the banks.
While stand the banks of England, England stands. When fall the banks of England, England falls.
Oh, for want of tuppence, the bank in Mary Poppins failed. Turns out the bigger they are, the harder banks are finding the fall these days. But when banking is face-to-face, money is suddenly simpler. Maybe smaller is better. Our 2 cents worth on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, October 9th, and perhaps smaller is better. We're going to talk to an executive from a small bank who says they're open for business.
Good morning, Adora. What else we got going?
Are you open for business?
I am open for business. And you know who else is open for business today?
Who?
Femi Okeh is here.
Oh,
Femi's back. Yes,
she's
indeed.
She's back. Today we're going to talk about the latest on the economy and its troubles. Also, our Patchwork Nation series, where we'll look at 408 counties that make up what's called Minority Central. And oil in Alaska, not the price or how much there is, but stories about the men off the frozen Arctic who get the oil out of the ground. But first, some headlines.
European markets are up a bit today. Key indices in the UK, France, and Germany are all up between 1.5% and 3%. More of a mixed bag for Asian markets. Japan's Nikkei index closed down a half percentage point, while Hong Kong and South Korea's markets gained. South Korea, Taiwan, and Hong Kong all cut key interest rates today. $120 billion, that's how much leading European central banks are offering to prop up lending between banks. This follows their interest rate cuts on Wednesday.
Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson has $700 billion on hand to help bolster U.S. financial institutions. He says he'll move quickly to use it, but also cautiously.
Every effort will require careful analysis, deliberation, and transparency, and some measure of patience from the American people as we create the most effective process possible.
Paulson says it will be several weeks before the program makes its first purchases of troubled assets. Insurance giant AIG is getting another pile of money from the Fed. The new $37.8 billion loan is on top of last month's $85 billion government bailout. The infusion comes just a day after AIG executives testified on Capitol Hill about lavish spending on a spa retreat just after getting the original bailout. TV ratings are in this week for the presidential debate. More than 63 million people watched Tuesday's contest. That's well above the first presidential debate, but still about 7 million fewer than tuned in for the VP matchup. McCain and Obama face off again on Wednesday.
On the campaign trail, Barack Obama's in Ohio. Joe Biden swings through Missouri. In sports, baseball's National League Championship Series opens tonight. The LA Dodgers visit the Philadelphia Phillies in the best of seven. Oil's around $88 a barrel in Asian trading, and the stock market is poised to open, at least in New York, positively. So here's a question that came up in the debate. Is healthcare a right of all Americans, or a more loosely defined responsibility of the government? What do you think? We're going to be talking about the candidates' health care plans today. Give us a call with your suggestion, 877-8-MY-TAKE. Do you have a right to get health care?
Or do you think the government should get involved in health care? Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Seems like we've been talking about healthcare for decades because, of course, we have been. It's an issue in the presidential campaign. It came up in the debate earlier this week. And the question is, Is there a right to health care? Is it a government responsibility? Is it your responsibility? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Your responsibility or a government right that you can demand at will? Speaking of government responsibilities, here's a few more.
Getting it right is as important as getting it done quickly. We can and we will do both.
That's Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson at an afternoon press conference yesterday outlining more steps the government is taking to intervene in the financial markets. After a day of nervous selling and jittery freaking out, the markets appear to be embracing stability this morning. The markets have not been wildly fluctuating like yesterday. It's a day after the unprecedented coordinated interest rate cut by the Federal Reserve, the Bank of England, the European Central Bank, and the Bank of China. Other banks have followed suit. U.S. futures are up today after a six-day losing streak, which saw indices falling by more than 15%. And today, the Bush administration is also reportedly considering taking ownership stakes in a number of U.S. banks, actually offering money to the banks in return for an ownership stake, much like the U.K. did yesterday. Michael Hunter joins us. He's on the line from London, and he's a reporter, markets reporter for the Financial Times. Michael, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, John. Good morning.
So a couple of things. Describe this arrangement. We certainly heard about it yesterday in London, that money is being offered by the British Treasury. And if banks take it, then they have to give up some sort of ownership stake to the government in London. But in Washington, is it going to work the same sort of way?
Well, we're not entirely sure what the Washington idea will be, how closely based on the what's now being referred to already as the British model, the Washington plans will be. But in terms of the British model, effectively, it's going to make the government a major holder of preferential stock in a series of UK high street lenders. According to one measure, when we've thrown the slide rule over the numbers as much as we can do at the moment, it would mean every taxpayer in the UK effectively holding about £1,600 worth of stock per capita in the banks. Now, the government's hoping that once the system is restored to something like normal, those preferential shares which it holds will rise in value, and the taxpayer should get much of the money put into the scheme back, if not all of it. And if it all goes really well, they could even see some kind of a profit in the long term.
Now, does that make you feel better as a taxpayer to be this sort of abstract shareholder who might get it right?
I think there's a lot of anger on the high street, similar to the kind of outcry that you saw over there in the States with the original Paulson bailout plan when that failed to get through the House of Representatives. But I think there's also a growing realization that people are aware that something really does need to be done, that we're looking at the kind of systemic crisis, you know, not seen since the war.
And certainly psychologically, the idea of personal savings accounts as an alternative to Social Security is a barrier that we've already crossed in the United States, this idea that the government would take ownership stakes. But let's review the bidding a little bit, Michael. I mean, we've got an insurance company, an AIG, that's owned by Washington, right? We've got now these banks that are being owned. We've got the Federal Reserve. I mean, what's next? ATMs by the federal government? It's a full-service economic institution, the federal government is. That seems pretty broad.
Well, I think what's happening is you're seeing the extent to which the hitherto private international financial system has to be underwritten by government. We're seeing that very, very clearly demonstrated with these changes in ownership, these nationalizations, governments taking shares in large hitherto private financial institutions, savings being underwritten around Europe and elsewhere in the world. And that shows you really exactly how national government really has always underpinned this system. And the way in which the private development of the system, the development of the system in private hands has failed, brings back to mind the central role that government really has always had to play in the system in setting interest rates, right, in underwriting it all.
Well, of course, not always playing that role. Well, I mean, at the turn of the 20th century, the private sector was really bailed out by the federal government the United States.
I think that's true.
And now we're seeing it on a global scale, it seems like.
We're also becoming, I think, a little bit more aware of the point at which market economics can't function on its own.
Right.
And when we've lost the degree of clarity which has always existed in traditional banking and things have become too complicated, the confusion that creates means governments have had to step in. And I think one of the main lessons we'll learn from the crisis is you can't have a situation where the only people who understand complex debt and financial instruments are the people who have written them and the people who are selling them to each other. I don't think regulators will let that happen again.
Right. Michael Hunter, markets reporter for the Financial Times, talking about the possibility of a broad democratization of the financial sector with all these transformations that are taking place. Question, Michael, thanks for joining us, by the way, from London.
My pleasure.
And question, is there any place where banking is simple?
No, exactly. As they struggle on Wall Street and topple, we wondered how smaller banks are doing on Main Street. And right now we have Mike Nelson, president and CEO of Pleasance County Bank in St. Mary's, West Virginia, on the line. Good morning and welcome, Mike.
Good morning.
So in the face of this meltdown on Wall Street, how is business in West Virginia?
Stable, secure, and I think the customers in our marketplace are leery and afraid of course, of all the media attention and all the drama they're seeing on television.
What makes your bank different from those who are really suffering from the collapses at the moment?
Well, Pleasance County Bank is a community bank, and we've been in St. Mary's, well, for 112 years now. And Pleasance County Bank is different from the large investment banks in that we deal directly right here in our community. We take local deposits, and we make local mortgage loans, automobile loans, and business loans. And when we put our loans on our books, we keep them to maturity or until they pay off or they're refinanced in some way.
So you're talking about a more conservative investment, but let me ask you this. Are people paying their mortgages and other loans?
Right now, yes. In West Virginia, I think we have a pretty good, stable banking environment. I'm not going to say that we're going to be insulated from a national or global recession. Our valley has quite a few chemical plants and coal-fired electric generating plants. And I think, you know, if this recession trickles down to the chemical plants in our valley and there's layoffs, and I think, you know, we're going to see some of the downturn also.
So that's really what you're watching for, is how the unemployment rate does in your state.
Exactly.
You know, I wonder, Mike, you're on a first-name basis with the guys who are paying your mortgages, right?
Oh, yes, we are.
I mean, you could probably rattle off a couple of first names of people who are paying, right?
Yes, and I'll tell you, they're concerned about their deposits. The best thing that came out of the relief bill for community banks, not only in West Virginia and probably nationwide, was the increase in the FDIC insurance. That went a long way to stabilize a lot of fears in our community.
Because are you spending a lot of your time reassuring your customers, and what kind of questions do they have?
I've spent a good part of my day the last 2 or 3 weeks reassuring customers. The difference, trying to reassure customers the difference between the word bank and investment bank and community bank.
Have you had to use the word casino to describe what's going on Wall Street?
Cha-ching, no. Not yet.
So in terms of the wider bailout plan, what do you think of it beyond the FDIC insurance going up? Are there other ways where it affects how you do business every day?
Not as much as it will in the larger cities and the larger markets. I understand the need to return cash flow nationwide and around the world to some type of a semblance of order, and between a lot of the larger banks, and I think, you know, we hear this on the national news. I mean, there's been a loss of trust in the banking business between banks, because no one knows who's going to be the next large failure or the next one that gets gobbled up because they're having problems.
And given that question of trust, have you had fewer applications for loans in the last days and weeks?
Oh, yes. I think it's been I think the process has really slowed down over probably the last 6 months. But really in the last month, it just seems like a lot of things have almost come to a complete halt. But there's still people out there buying some automobiles, mm-hmm. and we still have a few applications for people doing some remodeling and buying some homes.
Okay, Mike Nelson, thanks for joining us this morning. We really do appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mike Nelson, he's the president and CEO of Pleasance County Bank in St. Mary's, West Virginia, and he says they're open for business.
Open for business, but having trouble attracting loans that people aren't wanting to borrow. It's an interesting point, even though he knows the people he's lent to.
And not only that, but it's interesting how much time he's spending reassuring them.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I believe we miss it when we start talking about whether it's a right or a responsibility. It is something that we need, and I think it's a need and a burden that we share. So I think we should put it as such.
Healthcare, an issue in the campaign and an issue right here on The Takeaway. We're talking about it this morning. And 877-8-MY-TAKE, we want to hear your suggestion for what the urgency is in healthcare. Is healthcare a personal responsibility, a fundamental right? MyTake@thetakeaway.org is how you can register your opinion. Adora?
And John, today we're going to take another look past whether states are blue or red, Democratic or Republican, to what Dante Cheney calls our patchwork nation. It's a project he directs for the Christian Science Monitor. And the latest chapter today is what he calls Minority Central, looking at communities with large pockets of African Americans and also communities with large pockets of Native American voters.
You have communities here where the immediacy of a problem is more important than this longer term problem. The cost of food, the cost of gas, the cost of buying a new car, the cost of maintaining a home. Those things affect the communities here more than you would probably think the collapse on Wall Street.
That's Ed Pratt speaking, someone that you, Dante, interviewed. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So what makes up a Minority Central?
Well, these are places primarily that either have large concentrations of African American populations in them or a large concentration of Native Americans. And they also tend to have much lower than average median household incomes. So these are places where racial tensions tend to be something of an issue. And then also, as Ed was saying, these are places where the economy has kind of been an issue all year in terms of just being able to get by.
And so you've wrapped together 408 counties where this situation exists for a total of roughly 22 million people. So you're talking about counties where those people of color, they make up a group, but the actual county is majority white.
Yeah, it usually tends to be that way. There are some where it ends up being, majority African-American, but usually they're majority white. And the interesting thing we've seen is we've crunched a bunch of data looking at these people's attitudes toward race. And if you just look at whites in all the groups we have, these are the places where the tensions tend to be the highest, if you ask them. These are the places where African-Americans, quote-unquote, need to work harder to get where they're going, and they tend to have the least amount of empathy for the African-American situation in the U.S.
Because you're essentially talking about working-class communities where there is some competition for economic resources.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. These are people that are competing with each other.
And what are some of those specific ways that those racial tensions exhibit themselves?
Well, the community we have where we're watching this is Baton Rouge. That's where Ed is. And the interesting thing, one of the ways it manifests itself down there is you've got a city that's essentially evenly split between blacks and whites, but the schools, the public schools, are overwhelmingly black. They're 80% black, and that's not really about age. It's not like they have there are more black children than there are white children. There are two school systems. The white parents have pulled their children out of the public schools, a great number of them, and it's really created a two-tier education system in Baton Rouge. And I think if you went to a lot of these communities, you'd see if even if it's not along the lines of pulling the kids out, you would definitely see, even though they're blacks and whites, quote-unquote, living together, there are stark lines in these places on race.
And when you were talking to Ed, he actually added a bit of nuance even to that observation. Let's listen to him.
At the same time, you have seen another migration of, out-migration of African-Americans who have the money to move into the same private and parochial schools. It's now not just race that has changed the education, the public education system here, but it's money and class.
So Edward Pratt is a media relations director at Southern University in Baton Rouge, and he's also a blogger for your Patchwork Nation project. And so what was the point that he was making there?
Well, I mean, there is as we're seeing more broadly in this entire project, you know, one of the things we're noticing is the disparities growing between the rich and the poor. And what's happening is, you know, when African Americans get enough family, every American family's getting enough money, they're pulling out of the city and they're going to, you know, exclusive, you know, they're going to better communities. You know, they live in gated communities too, and they want their kids to have a better education as well. So what you really have left in a lot of the schools in Baton Rouge, and the schools are really struggling there, I mean, the state has had to take over a large number of them, is the, you know, the kids, they're largely minority kids from families that don't have a lot of money.
So you've got those racial and race issues and class issues right there on top. Let's talk about the election and how this seems to be, these issues seem to be playing out. What have you found?
Well, you know, the election down there is particularly interesting because, and in all these minority central communities, because the question is, what happens when there is, you know, an African American candidate on the ballot who could win? And you know, they're expecting down there to be a big increase in black turnout. They, you know, race has been an issue in politics. They've been dealing with pretty seriously down in Louisiana. You know, that Baton Rouge has endured two David Duke runs for a statewide office. So they've seen what happens in terms of just the tensions on the street between people. I mean, Ed, you know, can talk eloquently about this. Just people, you know, neighbors kind of eyeing each other warily because sometimes race down there, people act very nice on the surface toward each other. But when you talk to them for just a little bit, it doesn't take long for the you know, the issues to start bubbling up.
Dante Chinney, thanks again.
And thanks for having me.
Dante Chinney is the director of the Christian Science Monitor's Patchwork Nation Project, talking about minority central communities. Now we're going to turn to Femi Okeh, who's got the latest headlines for us. Femi.
Thanks, Adora. Just coming up to 29 minutes past the hour. Asian shares are up after South Korea, Taiwan, and Hong Kong all slashed interest rates today. That follows a coordinated rate cut led yesterday by five world banks. And actually, it's all about backing up the banks this morning in the news. Here in the US, the Treasury Department is said to be considering taking an ownership stake in banks. Officials would inject capital directly in hope that it would encourage banks to lend to one another. The plan is very similar to one that was announced yesterday in the UK. In Iceland, authorities say they'll take over the country's last remaining independent bank, and it's its third such takeover in recent days. And in the governments of France, Belgium, Luxembourg and European have agreed to give Dexia a year-long guarantee. And this comes in spite of an almost $9 billion cash injection from three governments last week. And finally, the national debt clock in Times Square, New York, is having its own economic crisis. The electronic billboard that shows the money owed by the U.S. government has run out of digits now that the U.S. public debt is over $10 trillion for the first time. So they're using a dollar sign for an extra one to help them out of their economic crisis.
Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Health care is a critical issue this election year. What do you think about it?
I think it's just for Americans to control their own insurance, but it's up to the government to help them, support them, especially the ones who are disabled like I am. I'm not just a disabled body. I am an enabled body who can do more things than what the government allows me to.
So what do you think? Is it a personal responsibility to figure out your own health care? How involved should government be? Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org with your thoughts.
And health care, of course, is one of the issues driving this campaign, and we want to explore as many as possible before Election Day. And joining us now to discuss the differences between the candidates on health care is Mark Pauly, who's a health economist at the Wharton School. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Sure.
I want to tee up two statements from the candidates to set the broad issues and see if there's enough contrast there to actually develop some kind of actual policy debate here. First, listen to John McCain, Mark.
I think it's a responsibility in this respect, in that we should have available and affordable health care to every American citizen.
John McCain saying health care is a responsibility and that it should be available for everyone, regardless of their health condition. Now, listen to this story that Barack Obama told the other night.
I think it should be a right for every American. In a country as wealthy as ours, for us to have people who are going bankrupt because they can't pay their medical bills. For my mother to die of cancer at the age of 53 and have to spend the last months of her life in a hospital room arguing with insurance companies because they're saying that this may be a pre-existing condition and they don't have to pay her treatment, there's something fundamentally wrong about that.
Okay, Mark, so Barack Obama talks about health care at the extremes, and certainly the tragic death of his mother is an extreme case, but an all-too-familiar case. And John McCain seems to be talking from more of a market perspective. Do these reflect two very, very different views of a health care system managed by the federal government?
I think they reflect different views of how they would structure the healthcare system, although I think the differences that would matter to ordinary citizens are much smaller than the ideological differences between the candidates.
So Obama's plan would actually broaden the number of people who are insured, yet it would still leave a number of individuals uninsured. How do you view, first of all, the cost of this plan and who it would primarily affect?
Well, the cost of the plan is somewhat debatable because the cost estimates depend in part on some assumptions made about improvements in efficiency, which I'm an optimist about, but we can't give guarantees that things like greater use of information technology and computers would lower costs and other things like that. I think the realistic take that you would have to have for either candidate's plan is that if you are a middle-class person who's paying taxes, you'll probably end up paying more taxes to reduce the number of uninsured people under either candidate's plan.
But under the Obama plan, as a medical consumer, would your life be simpler? Would you be having fewer arguments with insurance companies, that sort of thing?
In part, it depends on who you are. If you were in the situation of Obama's mother or the gentleman who you played the little clip for, that people in that situation would be much better off because the Obama plan will require insurers to accept high risks and provide them with at least some approved coverage. And so the people that we usually think of as most adversely affected by being uninsured, who are high risks, would have their situation substantially improved under the Obama plan. I need to say, however, that under McCain, although he proposes to do it differently, a person in that situation would also be in much better shape than now because McCain proposes to, working with the states, have a heavily subsidized so-called high-risk pool, where if you're a high risk, you basically would be entitled to get decent insurance coverage at a premium for you that that is affordable. So in both cases, the people at high risk are actually would be in much better shape under either candidate's plan than at present.
Let's take apart the McCain strategy on these high-risk pools. Basically, mm-hmm. you're putting groups of people who share medical characteristics together. together and subsidizing the cost of serving them to the point where an actual insurance program can exist. Is that a good strategy, or does it actually just aggregate the highest costs?
Well, the high-cost people are going to be high-cost no matter where you put them together. So I think the thing to be said in favor of that strategy is that it puts them in a situation where tax money, subsidized money, can actually be targeted to them, specifically to their need.
Now, when we talk to healthcare providers about the current system, which is a mix of private and public sector, nobody describes the system as simple in any way. Republicans like to say that a market-driven system is going to be more simple because it will be self-sustaining, whereas Democrats and people who are supporting a single-payer program say that will be a simpler approach. Do you think there's any clarity here?
Well, Obama is not supporting a single-payer system or single-payer system, depending on your point of view. I guess it depends on how you look at it. In both cases, people would have a choice of a variety of plans. The only real difference there is that in Obama's arrangement, you would have, in addition to choice of private plans, there'd be a public plan, sort of like you'd be able to choose the post office or FedEx. And then, of course, we're kind of conflicted here, I think. On the one hand, we want choice. On the other hand, choice is confusing. And when it comes to insurance, it's easy to make what seems like a good choice, and then after the fact, you wished you'd bought the insurance that specifically covered the disease you got, but you didn't know you were going to get it.
Right.
So it's kind of like a gamble. Either one will help to clarify, I think, the choices available to people, because they will set up arrangements where the subsidies will be much easier for people to understand, and the premiums that they would have to pay will be easier for them to understand.
Well, certainly the economic impacts are complicated enough, and it remains to be seen what impact there will be on public health with the adoption of either of these plans. Mark Pauley, thanks so much for joining us.
Very, very welcome.
Mark Pauley is a health economist at the Wharton School. He spoke with us from Wayne, Pennsylvania. And now, headlines from Femi Oke.
Thanks, John. Just coming up to 20 minutes to the top of the hour. European share prices are still volatile today, though they're mostly in positive territory. Large early gains in Moscow prompted a one-hour stop in trading. And this comes one day after five banks in different countries made a coordinated cut in a key interest rate. Several people are dead after a car bomb exploded this morning in Islamabad. The blast occurred near the city's main police headquarters, and it coincided with a parliamentary session briefing legislators on militant activities near the Afghan border. The leaders of Thailand's ongoing anti-government protests say that they're ready to surrender. The court dropped charges of treason against the protesters, and they'd led thousands to the main government offices in August, where they've been camping ever since. And finally, inflation in Zimbabwe is now at 231 million%. That's up 11 million% the month before. And many Zimbabweans are now, instead of carrying money around, they're actually bartering in order to obtain some very basic goods.
That just sounds unimaginable. Thanks, Femi.
But very practical.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning, I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
And I'm John Hockenberry, and you know, here's an economic history lesson. Back in the 70s, it wasn't depression people were so worried about, it was inflation. Yesterday, the federal funds rate, you may recall, stood at 1.5%. Well, that benchmark borrowing rate for banks in 1974 was more like 10%, while the Dow Jones Industrial Average was hovering around 600. There were massive job losses heading into the final months of 1974, and President Gerald Ford addressed a weary nation.
In his first inaugural address, President Franklin D. Roosevelt said, and I quote, "The people of the United States have not failed. They want direct, vigorous action, and they have asked for discipline and direction under our leadership."
President Ford dreamed of mobilizing the nation to work together to turn the economy around. With inflation rising despite a program of federal price controls, the federal government literally set the prices of all kinds of goods. Nothing was working. So the president decided to sign every American up as an inflation fighter.
A very simple enlistment form will appear in many of tomorrow's newspapers along with the symbol of this new mobilization, which I'm wearing on my lapel. It bears the single word win. I think that tells it all.
Win, that'll do it. It stood for Whip Inflation Now. But of course, when he introduced it to the nation in his nationally televised speech, President Ford kind of botched the acronym.
My conclusions are very simply stated. There is only one point on which all advisors have agreed. We must whip inflation right now.
Whip inflation right now. That's WIRN. Doesn't quite have the snap of win, but Americans got the point anyway. It was all about cutting costs on everything from energy to food. The president got positively giddy talking about the gardens Americans would plant to help out their grocery bills.
Do it yourself. Plant wind gardens for yourself or within your community. Pool other do-it-yourself skills, and you can.
But all the wind gardens and other do-it-yourself efforts didn't really work, and Whip Inflation Now became a campaign joke. The only national consensus on the economy during the Ford administration was that Gerald Ford should leave the White House, and he did when Jimmy Carter took over in 1977.
But I took office a couple of weeks ago in the middle of the worst economic slowdown of the last 40 years.
But the economy would do in Carter as well. The one-term president established an inflation czar who monitored prices and wages and expanded elements of the Republicans' price controls. In February of 77, the Dow Jones Industrial Average had made it to 950. The Fed funds rate had been cut in half to 4.7%. But still, inflation ground on.
Other nations will join and support us as we cut down our use of oil and increase our own production of energy.
But again, it was only a dream. Inflation wouldn't subside until well into the Reagan administration. By then, the Federal Reserve had raised the Fed funds rate up beyond 17%. Carter had no buttons to fight inflation. He did once officially ban his inflation czar from saying the word inflation. That's right. And reportedly, his frustrated advisor, a Cornell economist named Alfred Kahn, chose the word banana as a substitute.
We have no bananas. We have no bananas today. We've got string beans and onions and...
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday, October 9th, and Femi Oke has the latest headlines this hour. Good morning, Femi.
Good morning. It is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says Congress may have to go back in session to pass a second stimulus package. This one might be worth as much as $150 billion. President Bush has promised to veto any such legislation. The SEC's ban on short selling, which sparked a series of similar bans around the world, expired last night. It was supposed to be a timeout and restore equilibrium to markets, but the Wall Street Journal reports that the general view was that it added to market confusion and didn't do much to halt the slide in financial stocks. The White House has blocked a judge's order to release 17 Chinese Uyghurs at Guantanamo Bay. The appeals court judge said that they should be released due to lack of evidence. The world's fishing fleets are losing around about $50 billion in income every year. The UN and World Bank says that's due to depleted fish stock and poor management of individual fisheries. Another 16 people are dead in northern Mexico. Officials believe that feuding drug cartels are responsible. More than 3,000 people have been killed in drug-related violence in Mexico this year. And finally, this sounds like a great introduction. Who wouldn't want to get a welcome just like this one?
Please help me today in welcoming the next Vice President of the United States, John McCain.
Yay, the crowd goes wild. That was Jim Pacillo. He's a supporter of the Democratic presidential nominee Barack Obama, and he was actually introducing Joe Biden, not John McCain.
Oh, with friends like that, with supporters like that.
What do you think his punishment should be for that?
I wanted to hear the audience to see if they went, yay, what? Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah.
He's looking younger.
Yeah. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
Well, whether they get the names right or not, all the candidates are talking about health care.
As a society, we must decide whether or not we want to make it a right or not. I believe we should make it a right. This has been done in other countries in the industrialized world, and it's about time we did it as well.
Right or responsibility? What's your view? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. It's all about health care.
And John, now we turn to a fascinating story about Alaska's North Slope. Not a story about how much oil there is there in the National Petroleum Reserve, but about the people who work there in the barren tundra off the Arctic Ocean. Joining us now is writer Jean Maria Laskis, who was one of the few people to penetrate this tight-knit, isolated world, which she wrote about for GQ magazine. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, you really described this as a hidden world, and you went in with some assumptions, but you came out with a totally different perception. What did you find?
Well, let's just say first the assumption I think anyone would have going into a place where you're living in, you know, minus 45-degree weather, these workers, you know, where it's perpetually dark for several months a year. And you live without families. They do two-week shifts out on the ice. You know, my sense going in was I sort of expected to pity these people. How did you get stuck with this job, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But instead found a group of pretty pretty colorful characters who love it there, just love it.
I mean, you describe absolutely brutal conditions. You said perpetually dark, and it's a place, I love that sentence where you said it's a place where you have to leave your pickup running 24 hours a day or you just won't simply get it started.
Oh, yeah, they all do. They just run.
So tell us about Turtle, Kung Fu, Brain, Two Dogs, and those are actual people.
Yeah, these are the guys on the rig. I focused on the oil workers, the actual roughnecks, they're called, who you know are doing the job, and they all have rig names that come from God knows where, you know, in their history together. They were just really fascinating characters in that they all had a reason for being there that had nothing to do with oil and everything to do with maybe a family that they couldn't quite make work back home, so they had a family there that they made work. But it was a
so describe that, just to follow up on that.
Mm-hmm.
Give us an example. What wasn't working where they came from, and what was working in this very isolated community where they pull oil out of the ground?
Well, let's just take Two Dogs for example. He's probably my main character in this piece. You know, like so many of these guys, he had a really pretty severe history of addiction, a lot of addiction stories in this area, and I would say in a lot of Alaska in particular. And he just, you know, messed up a lot in his life and had a wife that he loved dearly and four kids and a history of abuse that made it so he couldn't be hugged. So he couldn't make the family work because he couldn't be touched. If he was touched, he'd break out in hives. But he goes up to the rig. He could run a family there of guys. These were like his sons. And it was easier, a lot easier. So, you know, for him it was a missing his family but not being able to do family.
And what are their days like?
Well, they work 12-hour shifts. And that would be, you know, it didn't matter whether it was morning, noon, or night because you could never tell. You could never tell what day it was, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. You're either working or you're sleeping. You're working or you're sleeping. You know, on the North Slope, there is nothing there. To the eye, to our eyes of the lower 48 living in towns and cities, there is, I don't mean just nowhere to go, like just a truck stop. There are no truck stops. There's no community. There's no church. There's no nothing. You're stuck out there in the ice. So when your shift is over, you know, you're basically going to bed and maybe watching some TV. There was nothing to do. You couldn't even go outside for a walk. It's too cold. So, you know, the world gets tighter and tighter and tighter and tighter the longer you stay there.
It took you a long time to get there, to get into one of these companies to see what's happening. Why did you work so hard, and what were the obstacles you faced?
Well, the North Slope in general, it's run by the three major oil companies, BP, ConocoPhillips, and to some extent Exxon. There really has not been much written about it in any way beyond, you know, if some exciting spill happens, which is kind of rare up there. An oil spill happens, and you'll have reporters maybe allowed in to cover an event. But in terms of just staying there and you know, absorbing the culture, I don't know that it's been done. And they certainly did not want me there. You know, the attitude was, why would we do that? Why would we open ourselves up to anyone sort of seeing the way that we live here? But little by little, small independent companies have started to move in, and an independent company called Pioneer Natural Resources is the first independent operator up there, who built this tiny little island, 6-acre island in the ocean, and they were willing to allow me to come along.
But why was it so important for you to get there?
Well, you mean for me to write about this
subject?
Well, I'm doing a lot of stories right now about just kind of the people who make America work, the people we're dependent on that we don't know. You know, we know we're dependent on oil. Where do we get the stuff? Who are the people getting it? These are actual human beings, you know, and we don't have any access to who they even are.
What's the one thing that you hope people who read your article learn about those people who are working in Alaska's North Slope?
I think that the one thing, this sounds kind of crazy, but I think that the one thing is to know that they exist, to know that there are people on the other end of this equation, that this isn't just some, you know, a bunch of machines that bring us this magic fluid that makes the world go around, that this is an industry filled with, you know, in some ways, and they're not made out to be heroes in my story, but it's certainly every sacrifice you can imagine in terms of just human comfort that these folks are living through.
Jean Marie Laskus, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
She is a writer, and she wrote about the men who work in Alaska's North Slope pulling that oil out of the ground.
Roughnecks cold under the collar up there in Alaska. This morning, we're also talking about health care on the program.
If education is a right in this country, why isn't health care a right as well?
Is health care a right or a responsibility? How have your health care options affected you and your family's life? Stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
And here's today's takeaway.
You can't have a situation where the only people who understand complex debt and financial instruments are the people who have written them and the people who are selling them to each other.
Financial Times market reporter Michael Hunter.
And check out our election coverage at vote2008.thetakeaway.org. You'll find tools for tracking the candidates and commentary from young voters on the issues that matter to them.
All of our election coverage you can find on our homepage at thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
And I'm Adora Udoji.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
A galaxy in trouble, a last resort.
Please, Commander, you are our last hope.
It will take time and bipartisan leadership, cooperation and collaboration, as well as well-conceived and executed policies to overcome the challenges our nation is facing. And we will overcome them.
In a global quest for economic stability, Paulson is the commander. Bankers in a meltdown, it turns out, can't be choosy. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, October 9th, and we're going to take a look at the secretary today, Secretary Paulson. He's got some new ideas on the table.
Good morning, Adora. He's ready to blast off, or he's in near-Earth orbit, depending on your position on the economy. Yes.
We will go in depth on the latest economic news. And also, Senator Elizabeth Dole is one of the country's best-known Republicans. We're going to take a look at her re-election race in North Carolina, which seems to symbolize some major obstacles her party faces, and a scientist who argues that the evolution of humans is over. First, these headlines.
Quit while you're ahead, humans. European markets are up a little bit today. Key indices in the UK and France are in positive territory. In Asia, it was more of a mixed bag, though much more positive than yesterday's record lows. Japan's Nikkei closed flat. The New York Times, our partner, is reporting this morning that the U.S. Treasury may take ownership stakes in U.S. banks. The Treasury has the authority to do that under the $700 billion rescue plan. It's similar to moves Britain announced yesterday.
Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson can do much more with that $700 billion, but he said he's going to move cautiously.
Getting it right is as important as getting it done quickly. We can and we will do both.
Paulson says it will be several weeks before the program makes its first purchases of troubled assets. Overseas in Pakistan, a suicide bomber attacked the main police barracks in Islamabad today. The blast wounded several people and came as lawmakers were attending a special meeting on growing threats from militants.
TV ratings are in for this week's presidential debate. More than 63 million watch. That's well above the first presidential debate, but still about 7 million short of the audience for the VP matchup. Maybe they'll just cancel Obama and McCain. But they're going to face off again, Obama and McCain, on Wednesday. On the campaign trail, McCain and Palin campaign together in Wisconsin. Barack Obama's in Ohio while Joe Biden swings through Missouri.
And tonight, the LA Dodgers take on the Philadelphia Phillies in Game 1 of baseball's National League Championship Series. The series opens in Philly. And the Dow dropped 2% yesterday to close at 92.58. The S&P lost a bit more than 1%, landing at 984. Oil settled around $88 a barrel in Asian trading.
After a day of jitters and nervous freakouts, the market seemed to be absorbing the bailout in the United States and the coordinated interest rate cut around the world. But we're talking about not the markets today, thankfully. We're talking about health care. Is it a right or a responsibility? It's an issue on the minds of the candidates, and we're tackling it as part of our series of issues that we're looking at between now and Election Day.
So
what do you think
about
health care?
A personal responsibility, or is it the responsibility of the government to make sure that everyone is covered, or something in between? Give us your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE or at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
We begin with a surprise in the literary world. The Nobel Prize for Literature has been announced. It's Jean-Marie Gustave Leclaizio, who in 1994, in a survey of French readers, 13% of them believed he was the greatest living French language writer. His first book, The Deposition, was published when he was 23 years old. He's 68 today and the winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature, which was announced just this morning, just a few seconds ago. After passing the bailout bill, the U.S. Treasury has found authority to dispense cash to banks across the country that desperately need it in hopes of convincing financial institutions to resume lending money to potential homeowners and other aspects of the economy. But what does it actually mean for the U.S. government to take an ownership stake in banks in return for offering capital to those same banks? Mark Landler joins us. He's the New York Times international economics correspondent. He's joining us on the line from Washington. Mark, thanks for being with us again.
Good morning.
This is a story that the Times is reporting, and it seems to follow similar steps taken in Britain yesterday. You know, the U.S. already seems to own a lot of financial assets at this point, from AIG all the way through to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. What would this add to the portfolio, shall we say?
Well, I guess the most important thing it would add is the ability to take what had been in the case of AIG and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, case-by-case decisions, and basically develop a systematic policy where the government could inject capital into banks, including banks that are not about to fail or in danger of failing, which is what you saw in the AIG case, in return for which the government would acquire an ownership stake. And the thinking behind it is that what you need to address to break the logjam in the credit market is the unwillingness, the inability of banks to lend money to each other. And one of the most direct and quickest ways to do that is to inject capital into them to improve their balance sheets and hopefully persuade them to resume lending. This is what the British have done. It's what the Swedes and the Japanese did in previous banking crises. And it's something that a lot of experts have expected to be the eventual step the U.S. will take. And now we're basically getting indications that, indeed, this is emerging as the favored option among the ones that have been already put on the table through the large bailout plan.
You know, with some benefit today, we don't have crazy volatility on the markets all across the world, so we can step back a little bit. Are these measures, and let's take them in total now, including the bailout package, are these measures stopgap anomalies and will eventually go back to the way we did business before? Or are we seeing a really broad, almost century-long march of the federal government's intervention into the markets, to the point that the markets actually are owners, part owners of the financial sector itself?
Well, there's no question that we're going to enter an era of profound change in regulation and probably greater government intervention in the financial system than we've seen in this country maybe ever. Although I never want to say ever, the Great Depression, there was a tremendous government role in turning around the economy. But what is interesting about this particular scenario is that if you look at other countries that have done it, notably Sweden, there is a precedent for governments going in, taking aggressive ownership stakes in banks, and then later when the situation stabilizes, and by later I don't mean a month later, but a couple of years later, the stakes are then sold, and sometimes sold at a reasonable profit. So it doesn't necessarily mean we have a permanently changed landscape, but certainly we have a landscape that's changed profoundly and for some period of time.
But Mark, at what point is it too much? How much is too much, and at what point is the market perhaps going to lose confidence that the government is going to be able to execute all of these things?
Well, I guess the question maybe ought to be asked, at what point is it enough? Because what we've seen so far is a flurry of measures, the most ambitious, most creative, most radical measures that anyone really contemplated. And the market's reaction to all of them so far, before this morning, was to continue to be paralyzed, to continue to be distrustful. And this particular action, it does have a precedent. It's not the first time anyone has ever tried it. It has worked in the past. And there is a growing belief that this may be the one thing you can do that's simple enough, it's relatively easy to understand, it's transparent, and it may be enough of a confidence booster. That doesn't mean, by the way, the government won't do the other things it was talking about doing. It will buy distressed mortgage assets from banks, which was, if you remember, the centerpiece of the bailout plan, and there will be some efforts to, mitigate losses on mortgages and foreclosures. So it's not that we won't be hearing about about these two other options as well. But this particular one seems to be gaining a lot of traction in Washington and on Wall Street.
And so far, the markets are stable. But the question is, confidence or not, will the arithmetic work out right, whether you're measuring credit default swaps at $62 trillion or more the subprime mortgage problem, which is in the billions, hundreds of billions? The question is, will $700 billion be more than a drop in the bucket? Mark Landler, international economics correspondent for The New York Times, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Now we're going to talk about something that you might have missed in this week's presidential debate, when Republican candidate John McCain made this proposal that was quite surprising to some.
As President of the United States, Alan, I would order the Secretary of the Treasury to immediately buy up the bad home loan mortgages in America and renegotiate at the new value of those homes, at the diminished value of those homes, and let people be able to make those payments and stay in their homes.
McCain's rival Barack Obama came out and said that would mean big losses to American taxpayers. It may not matter, though, because some say, or some believe, some argue, the bailout money may well be spent by the time either of them is in office. And joining us now is Brian Wingfield, Washington Bureau Chief of Forbes.com. Good morning, Brian.
Hi, how are you?
Many were surprised to hear a Republican making this kind of proposal.
Right.
So what McCain's calling this the American Home Ownership Resurgence Plan. What is it?
Well, essentially it's a proposal, as he mentioned in the debate, to buy about $3 billion worth of mortgages that have been foreclosed upon from lenders and borrowers directly. So that would go straight to the government's balance sheet.
And how would it work exactly?
Well, we don't have all the details. That's kind of the big question mark, the $300 billion question mark, I guess. Essentially, it would be very much like a New Deal type program where the government comes in and takes over mortgages directly from the borrower or the lender. Now, where we get that money, we don't know. He has said, or his campaign has said, that some of it could be used from that $700 billion in the bailout package, but I think Doug Holtz-Eakin, his top economic advisor, has also said that it could come from various government pots. But again, we just don't have the details on this program.
So it's all a bit fuzzy, but in terms of the bailout money, what's the argument is to be said that there won't be any come the end of January when one of them takes office?
Well, first of all, the Treasury wants to do this right. I mean, they want to get it done quickly, but they've said that they have to do it right. So I think it's going to be several weeks before we see any checks cut, or a figurative term, but I think any money go out to buy these troubled assets. But at the same time, they want to get as much out there as they possibly can. Now, the first $350 billion can be made immediately. There's $250 billion that can go straight away. Then the president has the authority to authorize another $100 billion. And then the remainder of that amount can be used at the president's discretion, but it has to be disapproved by Congress. So it doesn't have to be approved by Congress. Congress just has to say, no, we don't want this to go out. Even if Congress says that, the president has the right to veto that. So, you know, I think the government wants to get this money out as quickly as possible. I mean, I don't think it's in anybody's interest to hold on to this bailout money because, I mean, as we've seen just in the past month, what has happened to the economy, and it's flipped on its head. Who knows what could happen, you know, by January. So
exactly. So there's a lot of uncertainty out there. And given that, what do you then make of McCain's proposal?
You know, I have to say, personally, I don't think this proposal is going to go anywhere. I think that it falls into the same league as the gas tax holiday that he proposed earlier in the summer. I mean, it's an interesting idea.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that's gotten a lot of attention. But I think the economic landscape is going to change so much within the next 3 months that I don't think this is going to have much of a future.
Brian Wingfield, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Brian Wingfield is the Washington Bureau Chief of Forbes.com. He put it in the same league as the gas tax suspension, John.
But one of our listeners said yesterday that the government's already doing that. They own Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They're already buying mortgages to the tune of like $5 trillion.
So it all feels a little mushy, doesn't
Maybe.
It? A little fuzzy, mushy.
Yeah.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. On healthcare, what's your preference, socialize or privatize?
I lived overseas for a while, and I found that socialized medicine was great. I lived in New Zealand, and I think it's just because of money that we haven't done it. It's all about greed.
What should we do with our healthcare system? What are the options? We're talking about it in regards to the campaign, but also as far as your future is concerned. 877-8-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And speaking of the election year, the campaigns, while the presidential candidates are battling it out, there are a growing number of Republican Senate candidates who find themselves in a precarious predicament. And a good example of that would be the mounting obstacles for U.S. Senator Elizabeth Dole. Now, she's one of the most well-known women Republicans in the country. And a year ago, she was a shoo-in for re-election, but her Democratic challenger, State Senator Ken K. Hagan, has been picking up speed. Joining us now to discuss this is Rob Christensen, who's been watching closely. He's a longtime reporter and a columnist for North Carolina's News and Observer newspaper. He's also the author of The Paradox of Tar Heel Politics, the personalities, elections, and events that shaped modern North Carolina. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what happened to Dole's lead?
Well, a lot of things happened. And the main thing is the national trends. Elizabeth Dole was recruited to run in 2002 by Karl Rove to replace the ailing Senator Jesse Helms. President Bush campaigned for Elizabeth Dole five times in 2002, which was the most of any candidate campaigned for, with the exception of his brother Jeb Bush down in Florida. And this time, of course, Bush's numbers are in the tank. The president has not been on the scene on the campaign trail and won't be, obviously, with Elizabeth Dole. And so Elizabeth Dole is facing a surprisingly tough challenge. A couple things going on here. One is that that North Carolina's economy, like the rest of the country, has been hurting. The Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, led by Senator Schumer, has pumped millions of dollars into Kay Hagan's campaign, which has helped equalize the funding in the race. Dole had a wide margin, and there have been pretty effective ads. I think the most effective ad.
We actually have one of those ads, because I was going to ask you, have things gotten, I don't know if nasty is the right word, but certainly intense. Let's listen to this ad.
I'm telling you, Liddy Dole is 93.
93?
Yep. She ranks 93rd in effectiveness.
After 40 years in Washington?
After 40 years in Washington, Dole is 93rd in effectiveness, right near the bottom.
I've read she's 92.
Did I just tell you she's 93?
No, 92% of the time she votes with Bush.
What's happened to the Liddy Dole I knew?
She's just not a go-getter.
So, Rob, clearly a jab at her age. You have, she's actually 72 years old, but the tone of that, is that a low blow?
Well, it depends on who you talk to, obviously. They're obviously making her age an issue. Of course, she's the same age as John McCain. But I think it also plays on the fact that she's a Washington figure. She's been, the 92-93 is a double-edged thing. It talks about her age, but it really is talking about some ratings have shown her as fairly ineffective. It's trying to show her as out of touch. She has always had a little bit of a problem of the carpetbagger issue. She was born and raised in North Carolina, but she spent her entire career in Washington.
And she came back out swinging. She's clearly not taking any of this laying down. Let's listen to an ad that she put together against Hagan.
They call her Fibber K. Hagan. Fib after fib, she tries to turn us against Elizabeth Dole. But we know Elizabeth has been consistently voted one of the 10 most admired women in the world.
So, Rob K., a fibber, is that based on something particular?
There's been a whole series of attacks on Elizabeth Dole, and so they're coming back, and they're, of course, using a dog, and, of course, the imagery there is pretty self-evident. I think one of the interesting things is that when she ran in 2002, she ran against a man, Erskine Bowles, former Clinton White House chief of staff, and he was reluctant to go after her, in part because this is a socially conservative state, and it's the Southern lady sort of thing, and you have to be very careful going after a woman candidate. Now we have two women candidates, so the gender issue is no longer on the table, and that has allowed Kay Hagan to go after Dole's race.
And Rob, I'm just going to interrupt you there because I want to bring in senior editor of Essence, Patrick Henry Bass, who's been watching this race closely for lots of reasons. But this time, it is a different race for Senator Dole.
It is a very different race. What I'm really concerned about, what I wonder about, are Obama's coattails. Is Kay helping Obama or vice versa?
I think traditionally the Republican candidate has had coattails in North Carolina because the state hasn't gone Democrat for president since Jimmy Carter in 76. This time it's totally changed because North Carolina is a battleground state. So the thinking is that Obama, whether he wins the state or not, he has made it competitive and he has a huge ground operation in this state, and that he probably brings in another 2%. So if this race goes into Election Day tied, then there's probably the tie goes to the Democrat, in this case, Hagan.
One more question. What is Obama getting right that Harvey Gantt did not when he ran against Jesse Helms in the early 90s?
Well, of course, this was a long time ago, and the state's changed. A lot of people moved into the state, and also racial attitudes have changed. And also, Gantt was running against an incumbent, and
Helms was in the picture. That was the big one. Yeah.
That was the big one.
Wow. Rob, one we've seen in Georgia where African-American registration is through the roof. I'm wondering if that's going on there, and if the fact that Charlotte is such an important center in this whole banking crisis that's going on has also influenced this race.
Well, if you look at voter registration increases since January, there's an 8-to-1 advantage, Democrat over Republican, in North Carolina.
Wow.
And that's part of that's African-American, of course, but it's also a lot of young people. There's a lot of colleges, universities here. And the second part of the question, Charlotte is, the second largest banking center in the country, and there's a lot of concern about one of the major business institutions in the state and whether that will survive, and if so, will there be large layoffs and so forth. So, but that is, we've already had that discontent across the state in textile mills and so forth. Now we're seeing it in some of our blue chip newer industries like banking.
Wow.
Rob Christensen, we want to thank you for that snapshot.
Interesting stuff.
Sure.
Rob Christensen has been a reporter and columnist for North Carolina's The News and Observer newspaper for 35 years. He's also the author of The Paradox of Tar Heel Politics, Personalities, Elections, and Events that Shaped Modern North Carolina.
And Patrick Henry Bass,
senior editor at Essence, is going to stick around with us for a bit.
Work on your French, Patrick. I'll explain in a minute.
Merci.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Thursday, October 9th, and we have the latest headlines for you from Femi Okeh. Femi?
Thanks very much, Adora. Just coming up to 28 minutes to the top of the hour. The ban on short selling is over. The ban was intended to be a timeout to allow markets time to recover from recent turmoil. The ban ended last night.
In Iceland, authorities say that they're taking over the country's last remaining independent bank. It's the third such takeover in recent days. The country has decided to suspend trading on its stock exchange until Monday. And in the governments of France, Belgium and Luxembourg, they've all agreed to give European lender Dexia a year-long guarantee. The Democratic Republic of Congo is calling for an urgent meeting of the UN Security Council. They believe an attack by Rwanda on the eastern city of Goma is imminent. Rwanda has strongly denied the allegations. Alaska Senator Ted Stevens' trial will go on and on and on. A federal judge has refused yet another request from the defense for a mistrial. They'd argued that prosecutors violated rules of evidence by intentionally withholding information. In baseball, the National League Championship Series kicks off tonight in Philadelphia, and the Phillies host the LA Dodgers in Game 1, and the ALCS starts tomorrow in Tampa Bay as the upstart Rays take on the Red Sox. That's a look at some of your stories making news this morning.
Thank you,
Thanks
Femi.
Very much, Femi. And we're talking about health care today, obviously a key issue in the presidential election, but we were looking for your thoughts.
I think nobody should make money off of health care. Nobody should make money off of somebody else's cancer.
What do you think? Should we make our health care system free? Are you or the government responsible for health care? Give us a call at 8778-MYTAKE or drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Health care is one of the issues we're looking at as we tee up the election now less than 4 weeks away. Joining us now is Dr. Herbert Pardes, who is president and CEO of New York Presbyterian Hospital and Health Care System, a position he's held since 1999. He's also a distinguished psychiatrist. Dr. Pardes, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you.
Now, you hear the sentiments. They're relatively bitter sounding of that person saying, you know, no one should make money off of cancer. You are president and CEO of the New York Presbyterian Hospital and Healthcare System, a giant company that is in business in healthcare. How do you respond to that?
We are a nonprofit, and any monies that come into the hospital are used for the healthcare of the patients.
Let's take a look at from the perspective of a healthcare provider. If citizens and taxpayers say again and again that they want security and availability in their healthcare system to deal with the health problems that they can't necessarily foresee, what is the number one requirement on the wish list for healthcare providers like your company?
I think that there should be coverage and access made available for all citizens of the United States.
Would that simplify matters? We hear stories of healthcare providers who actually take on staff to deal with the various insurance programs and requirements and paperwork required to even get the simplest thing paid for.
You're putting your finger right on it. One of the big issues is the amount of administrative work, money, expense being expended, which I think could be reduced dramatically if we found ways of streamlining the administrative aspects of the healthcare system.
It's estimated that more than 47 million Americans are without health insurance. Is this an economic issue or is it a public health issue? And if it is a public health issue, how does it manifest itself in the health of the U.S. population?
Well, I think to some degree you could consider it as both. For example, when people don't have coverage, don't have a regular physician to go to, what they often do is use the emergency room as their doctor. That brings a number of people into the emergency room who really do not need emergency care. And it also overcrowds emergency rooms and makes it more difficult for the other patients who are coming in. Now, in addition, what happens is people delay going for care, and often the illness gets worse, so that sometimes the ability to treat them effectively is reduced, and also the likelihood of a good recovery is reduced, and further, the cost of a more complicated situation is increased.
Well,
so
how
I
would
think
you,
all of those are bad results.
How would you deal with various populations that have a really large impact in emergency rooms, say at New York Presbyterian, say people with asthma, people with the chronic care problems like diabetes? How would you recommend that an insurance system take care of that population?
I think that should, for example, with diabetes, which is a very good example, since it is so big a cost in the system, what I would do is have a reimbursement system which allows diabetes centers to provide comprehensive care. Often, if you have a young person who's diagnosed with diabetes, what happens is the medical care system is covered for a limited portion of what they do. You have a young teenager who gets diabetes, what you want is that person may need help from a nutritionist, a behaviorist, somebody who can work with him on exercise, and those costs are not covered. As a result, the care is not as comprehensive as it could be. If you did give comprehensive care and the young person took better care of himself, he would reduce the likelihood that he would have any of the massive number of complications of diabetes, which, again, are very costly.
Let's stay on the diabetes example here, then. Dr. Pardis, would you support a McCain approach to subsidizing high-risk pools for people with diabetes if part of the consequence of that subsidy was it created comprehensive health care facilities to deal with the very things you're talking about?
Well, I would support anything which provides the ability to people providing the care to give comprehensive diabetes care. We've done that ourselves at New York Presbyterian. We set up a very comprehensive diabetes center, and what we found is the only way to make it work financially has been through philanthropy because the reimbursement system doesn't cover the costs.
So if the healthcare system that proposed either by Barack Obama and or John McCain doesn't deal with paying for comprehensive care, it's not going to have an impact on general health in the United States.
Well, it certainly will have a fault in that people with that particular illness will more frequently not be covered completely, and as a result, you may not have as strong a provider system for them. Incidentally, I think important in diabetes is this is a shared responsibility. So people who have diabetes, if they take care of themselves and learn how to take care of themselves, they often protect themselves from, again, what I said were all kind of complications, which means heart disease, vascular disease, kidney disease, and many others.
Do you think having a health care provider and getting insurance is a responsibility that's part of an individual's overall health care responsibility to stay healthy?
I think that it's a shared responsibility. I think the government has to be in there to help, and I think people have to take some responsibility themselves. But the goal should be that they're all covered.
Right.
And that means they get treatment when they should get. They go for regular checkups so that we catch things early, and therefore when they're less serious. And that means emergency rooms remain for people who have conditions that have to be treated in emergency rooms.
Well, I wish we could do something to improve the health of your phone line there, but it's been great talking to you. Dr. Herbert Pardis is president and CEO of New York Presbyterian Hospital. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. And this morning, not long ago, the 2008 Nobel Prize for Literature was announced, and the winner is a French writer, Jean-Marie Gustave Le Clézio. He not only gets a gold medal, but also a $1.4 million check. Joining us to talk about this win is Patrick Henry Bass, who is a senior editor at Essence Magazine, a book editor. And Patrick, you say this is a big surprise.
This is an upset. I'm sure right now Amos Oz wants a recount of the jury. Like, the short list was Amos Oz. It was Haruki Murakami, the Japanese writer. It was Adonis, who everyone thought was going to get the Nobel Prize.
The Syrian poet.
Phenomenal. Mario Vargas, let me get it right. Mario Vargas Llosa.
Llosa.
The Peruvian writer was seen as a shoo-in. There was a lot of controversy over this, you know, particular Nobel in literature for 2008 because of, you know, one of the Swedish judges who
let's
said some
get to that in
words.
One second, but just let's talk about Le Clézio, who is described by the Nobel Committee as someone who's been writing since they were 7 or 8. There was a survey in the 90s done in France that named him among 13% of the population as the most gifted French writer alive. So quite a following, at least there
right,
in France.
Right. JMG, as we can say. John, how would you want to say his last name? Laclisio. He's published at least 30 books in France. And the French do revere their writers. You know, they really do, in ways that sometimes I think Americans don't.
But also, the Nobel Prize for Literature has never been a popularity contest. I mean, the Nobel Committee takes it as a matter of honor to introduce writers to the world of readers as much as honoring writers who are blockbuster famous already.
Exactly, although Ernest Hemingway won a Nobel Prize, you know, William Faulkner won a Nobel Prize. Toni Morrison, the last American to win a Nobel Prize in 1993. Doris Lessing had always done pretty well in terms of sell.
But Kenzaburo Oe, Japanese writer, introduced to the world as a result of the Nobel.
Harold Pinter had no problem getting work done, and he won a Nobel Prize as well. So it's mixed, I would say.
Grisham's Nobel, you know, was
Nicholas Sparks is next, I predict that.
Let's quickly talk about the intrigue here, of course, was not only who was going to win, but from which country the winner would come from, and why was that even an issue?
Because of the jury never reveals themselves. It's quite anonymous, but Horace Engelhardt, I guess, one of the jurors for the Nobel Committee, you know, came out and basically called American writers hacks, you know, essentially, you know. And it would say that American writers are too provincial, because people have wondered for the longest time why Philip Roth or Joyce Carol Oates, who have now become the Susan Lucci's of the Nobel Prizes.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Poor Joyce Carol Oates. She's staggering.
She's working on three books right now. There'll be three books in 2009 from Joyce Carol Oates.
Essentially, he said that American writers are inhibited by their own ignorance.
It was unfortunate what he said, but I think it brings up a very good point. Like, if you look at most of the major publishing houses, there are Nobel candidates like Chinua Achebe, who's never won a Nobel Prize. You know, Nigerian writer. But it's not as if the American writers, Don DeLillo, Joyce Carol Oates, Philip Roth, it's not as if they are moving in that direction towards the Nobel Prize. It's all about the sales.
Patrick Henry Bass, you're going to stick with us.
Yes,
senior editor from Essence Magazine.
Talking about Nobel winner Jean-Marie Gustave Laclisio.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We begin with headlines from Femi Oke.
Hello there. It is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says that Congress may have to go back in session to pass a second stimulus package. This one might be worth as much as $150 billion. President Bush has promised to veto any such legislation. American businesses can now sell nuclear fuel and technology to India. President Bush signed a bill ending a ban on American nuclear sales to India. In return, India will allow U.S. inspectors into its civilian, although not military, nuclear plants. In Pakistan, there have been two bombings in the northwest. A roadside bomb detonated near a prison vehicle ended up killing several school children on a school bus driving by the same time. And the other bombing was in Islamabad, where a suicide bomber there attacked the city's main police headquarters and wounded several people. Inflation in Zimbabwe is now at 231 million%. That's up 11 million% from the months before, and many Zimbabweans have now resorted to bartering in order to obtain basic goods. And finally, have a listen out to this new campaign song used by John McCain.
That's it. I'm voting for McCain. Foo Fighters.
Isn't it great? I've been playing it really loud in the newsroom.
It's over for me. I'm not undecided anymore.
Except that the Foo Fighters have said, we don't want you to use our music for your campaign song. Where have we heard this before? Well, let me remind you. We've had Hart and Jackson Browne and John Cougar Mellencamp. They've all said they didn't want their songs used by the Republican
Paris Hilton.
But, of course. But If the campaigner buys the song, they pay the rights, they pay the copyright, they can do whatever
just
they
like. Anyone else. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
So, at last estimate, there are about 6 billion people on the planet.
Oh, so listen to me, get up off your knees, cause only the strong survive. That's what she said.
Only the strong, 6 billion strong people on the planet? I think not. Steve Jones is joining us now. He's a professor of genetics at University College London. And he says, in fact, natural selection, the major engine of evolution, is dormant in the human species at this point. Evolution has essentially stopped because only the strong do not survive in the community of human beings. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Hi.
What does it mean that the strong don't survive? Natural selection is switched off and we aren't evolving anymore.
Okay, well, let's step back just a little bit and ask what natural selection is, okay? Natural selection I often think of as a factory for making almost impossible things. The eye, the elbow, the appendix, they all come from natural selection. And the process turns on differences. Natural selection is inherited differences in the ability to reproduce. And if there are lots of differences around, there's plenty of potential for natural selection. If there are no differences around, and I argue actually that in the developed world at least, and in fact across much of the globe, there are very few differences now of that kind around, then natural selection has no fuel and it can't work.
Now, is this a speculative observation that you're making, or is there something about the cells and the transmission of DNA in human species right now that indicates something has switched off?
Well, it's almost childishly simple. I mean, I've had lots of sort of hate mail from people who say I'm crazy, and I may well be, but I'm not crazy about this particular item.
It's all the other stuff you're crazy about, yeah.
I tell my undergraduate students in their first lecture, look to the person to your left and the person to your right, and 2 out of every 3 of you will die for reasons connected with the genes you carry. And that's approximately speaking correct. And they look a bit glum at that. And then I say, well, don't worry about it, cheer up, because if I'd been speaking in Shakespeare's time, 2 out of 3 of you would be dead already. And in Darwin's time, even 1859 or so, 1 out of 2 would be dead. So in the 16th century, 2/3 of all British babies were dead by the time they were 21. Nowadays, something like 98 or 99% of all babies survive. So there are no differences anymore. We all stay alive until we're old enough to reproduce. In the old days, many of those babies died for genetical reasons. They had genes that made them susceptible to cholera or to cold or to starvation. But now we all stay alive. No differences.
Okay. And would you say that healthcare makes life less arduous and therefore makes natural selection or genetic difference less of a factor in whether people survive or not?
Sure. I mean, various things have helped. Healthcare has helped, of course. Some sewers have helped. Reduction in violence, which used to be far worse than it is today, has helped. There's not much starvation anymore. They've all helped. But what they've done is to make the central point is we all stay alive for long enough to reproduce. But, of course, it's a two-part exam. And the second paper is maybe more fun to sit. But the range of marks is much, much higher, because in order to pass on your genes, you have to find a mate and persuade him or her to collaborate with you in the messy task of producing excess DNA. Okay.
Right, which we would call progeny. Well, let me turn to my fellow humans here in the studio to see if they back you up on this issue of evolution being stopped. Adora?
Steve, question for you. Are you saying that scientists and doctors know so much about the ways that genes and the way that our DNA works that you can say with certainty that we've developed as far as we're going to go and you know that there's going to be no changes possible in the future?
No, I mean, that's too strong a statement. I mean, that's two different statements. I mean, first of all that matters are these figures about difference. Where they come from is neither here nor there. To be frank, scientists, geneticists know almost nothing about the way in which genes work. Occasionally we delude ourselves that we know a bit, but in all frankness, we're looking over the edge of an abyss of ignorance. But as long as everybody stays alive long enough to have children and has roughly the same number of children, then there is no opportunity for natural selection. It cannot work. So you don't need to know the mechanisms. You just need, don't worry about the mechanisms, ask about the figures, and they're straightforward.
Is there a minimum? This is Patrick Bass here. Is there a minimum number of children or a maximum number of children that could?
Well, I mean, that's the second part of the argument. We all stay alive effectively until we're old enough to reproduce. If you look around the world and look into the past, historically it was the case that there was a massive amount of variation in the number of children that particularly men had. Now, women, of course, are limited by simple biology as in the number of kids they can have. But men, in principle, if they can persuade somebody to collaborate with them, could have any number. Mohammed bin Laden, who's Osama's father, had 22 wives and 53 children.
He's very highly evolved.
Osama himself, last time we counted them, had 5 wives and 22 children. I picked up one guy who was called Mullah Ismail the Cruel of Morocco, who admitted to having had 888 children. And that's a lot.
I know Dennis Rodman's father had like 23 kids.
Oh, my God.
They're highly evolved.
Dennis Rodman. Let me just finish that argument.
Sure, sure. If one guy has 22 wives, then there are 21 other guys out there who don't have any wives at all. So there's a massive variation in the number of children. You look nowadays, and that's all gone. Most of the world, most people have 0, 1, 2, 3, 4 children. That's it. No differences. No more chance for natural selection.
Last question, Steve. Is it possible that humans are developing not in the genetic, traditional sort of evolutionary way, but are interacting with machines and technology, and that this sort of hybrid machine-human domain is where humans are doing most of their development now?
Yes, for sure. I mean, we're doing it now. We're actually doing something almost miraculous, is that we're talking to each other across the Atlantic. You tend to forget how amazing that actually is. And the odd thing about human evolution is actually, if you look backwards, how little of it there's been in physical terms. If an early modern human came and sat on the tube next to me in London, in the rather rough part of London in which I live, I probably wouldn't notice. I mean, he might be covered in furs and grunting, but this is central London, what do you expect?
Go to Brixton, you can find that, sure.
So it's not physical change that's made us, it's mental change, and it's mental change that will make the future.
And is there precedent for that kind of evolution in other species?
I don't think so, really. I mean, people are, you know, there's a lot of controversy about the claim that we share 98% or so of our DNA with chimpanzees. Well, maybe we do, but we're not 98% chimpanzee. We're not chimpanzee at all.
Right.
We're entirely human. And actually, to me, the theory of evolution makes me feel much more unique and human and special than I would have felt without the theory of evolution, because you can see how much we've stepped outside the arena of Darwinian natural selection and so on.
We've done it on our own.
The rest of life.
Right, we've done it on our own. Steve Jones, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Steve Jones is a professor of genetics at University College London, and he was in a studio there in London for us. That was great.
Certainly some food for thought there, and I'll let you know we're always on at the takeaway.
And here is your takeaway.
The government has to be in there to help, and I think people have to take some responsibility themselves. But the goal should be that they're all covered.
That's Mark Pauly, health economist at the Wharton School, talking about whether health care is right or a responsibility.
Have you stopped evolving, Patrick Henry?
I'm going to evolve enough to read L'Ecclesia. I'm going to catch up on it.
Yeah, that's right. The Nobel Prize for Literature winner today.
That's right.
If you missed anything this morning, you can catch up with us on Friend Feed, and you can download the podcast that we have to go each morning on iTunes. You'll find the links on our homepage, thetakeaway.org.
And I'm Adore Udoji.
And I'm John Huckenberry. There's a lively conversation about healthcare happening on our website. Go there at thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.